You're listening to the Biographics Podcast. This episode is something that originally aired on a YouTube channel we do. If you'd like to get the latest videos before they come to the podcast form, please do consider heading over to YouTube and just plug in Biographics, spelt the same way that this podcast's name is spelt, and you will see all of our videos. They were designed for video first, but we just wanted to make them accessible to people in the podcast format. So please consider doing that. Also, if you'd like to leave us a review, a rating, wherever you get your podcasts, that would be amazing. It really does help us out. It gets this in front of more people, which is always a good thing. It really keeps us making it. I like reading the reviews. So there's that. And let's get into today's episode.
He's the dentist's son who grew up to become the world's youngest billionaire. In the mid-2000s, Mark Zuckerberg created a website that defined a generation, a website you almost certainly use yourself. The behemoth that is Facebook today, it dominates the internet. It has more active users than the populations of China and India combined. At the time of writing, it's worth around $500 billion. It's also at the center of some massive controversies that have dominated the headlines. Yet, how much do most of us know about the man behind the business? Maybe you've seen the movie The Social Network, which reimagines Mark Zuckerberg as a kind of Lex Luthor of the internet, using his genius to crush his enemies. There's an element of truth to that, to be sure, but the real Mark Zuckerberg is far more interesting, far more nuanced, and far more tragically flawed. Rich, brilliant, idealistic. This is the story of how one privileged kid from small town New York created a digital empire, only to see all his good intentions collapse into dust. If you were living among the clapboard houses and leafy streets of Dobbs Ferry, New York in the mid-90s, there would have been one neighborhood kid who you were sure was going to go far. And that would have been Mark Zuckerberg. Born in nearby White Plains on May 14, 1984, young Mark was a veritable prodigy. Taught Atari basic programming language as a child, by age 12 he was creating sprawling games from his friend's childhood drawings. By his mid-teens, he'd built an early messaging app called ZuckNet that allowed the family to communicate with his dad's dentistry business online in real time. When Mark ended up transferring to the super prestigious Phillips Exeter Academy for a graduate computing course, no one was in the least bit surprised. The Zuckerbergs had always been a family of brain boxes. Dad, Edward, was a dentist and Mum, Karen, was a psychiatrist, and the family always encouraged learning in their four children. But Mark, he was something else. A polyglot, he'd taught himself how to speak French, Hebrew, Latin, and ancient Greek. He was captain of the fencing team. He devoured classic literature. Along with a friend, Adam D'Angelo, he'd even programmed a media player so advanced that it sparked a bidding war between Microsoft and AOL. In short, Mark was one of those privileged kids you can tell are destined to forever roll double sixes in the game of life. He had the talent to go far, and he had the competitive drive too. On a form around this time, he actually listed defeating nemesis as his hobby. So when this wunderkind landed a place at Harvard in 2002, it was just another step on that great long staircase of privilege that led to the heaven of a high-flying job and a home in the Hamptons. Only this particular staircase, it came with a stumbling block. This was one that would initially trip 19-year-old Mark up before accidentally showing him how to climb far higher than he'd ever dreamed. The name of that block? Well, that was loneliness. So here's the thing about going to Harvard as a small-town genius. You're suddenly surrounded by other geniuses for the first time in your life, and some of those geniuses might be so clever that you start to look a little less special and just a bit more ordinary. In a 2008 profile, Rolling Stone claims that this was exactly what happened to Mark Zuckerberg. Isolated among so many other Harvard brainiacs, he retreated into programming, abandoning his social life for an online world where he could still shine. He created a popular site called Course Match for his fellow students, which gave him an insight into what made people tick. But Course Match, it wasn't the work of a genius. It didn't even make him stand out from the crowd as he so desperately craved. No. He would have to wait until his sophomore year to do that, because that was when he created a little something known as FaceMash and exploded Harvard society. In October 2003, Mark Zuckerberg sat in his dorm room, drunk and alone and consumed by depression. He'd just been jilted by one Jessica A., and like every young man unlucky in love, he turned to alcohol to numb the pain of existence. As he morosely blogged about the bitch who had betrayed him, 19-year-old Zuckerberg began flicking through Kirkland Dorm's Facebook. That's Harvard lingo for the online photo directories of students that each dorm keeps. His ego wounded, Zuckerberg let his negative thoughts flow into his blog. "Some of these people have pretty horrendous Facebook pics," he wrote. "I almost want to put some of these faces next to pictures of farm animals and have people vote on which is more attractive." The more alcohol Zuckerberg consumed, the more he began to take the idea seriously. Maybe not with the farm animals, but why not put up two pictures of students and have other students vote on who was the hottest? Before long, Zuckerberg was thinking of his idea as more than just a way of lashing out at a world that had wounded him. It would be an epic prank, one that would no doubt go down in Harvard history. By the early morning, he'd successfully hacked all of Harvard's dorm directories, scraping away private user data and blogging about his prank every step of the way. Before the sun rose, FaceMash, it was live. In no time at all, 450 people had viewed the site 22,000 times. Years later, the 2010 movie The Social Network would suggest Facebook itself grew out of FaceMash, which isn't quite true. But FaceMash does remain key to understanding Zuckerberg. The scale and speed of the positive response to his prank site, it opened his eyes. As he would later say, "People are more voyeuristic than I would have thought." It's a revelation he would soon leverage into huge business success. Not that any of that was guaranteed that cold October night. FaceMash was only live for a few hours before Harvard shut it down and hit Zuckerberg with the mother of all disciplinary actions. He could be suspended or even expelled. And then what would his mum and his dad think? Yet for all of the stress that it caused him, Zuckerberg came out of the FaceMash debacle having gained something invaluable. He was special again. He was no longer a nobody. He was a computer genius and a prankster hero. Zuckerberg was even able to leverage his newfound notoriety into a date with a medical student called Priscilla Chan, and trust me, that is a name you are going to be hearing again and again. On November 19, 2003, Harvard's disciplinary board dropped its privacy violation charges against Zuckerberg. The prankster bought a bottle of champagne and cracked it open with his roomies to celebrate. Finally, he had a place in the world again. All through 2003, Harvard had been a campus that was buzzing with ideas. These were the heady days of Web 2.0, and social technologies were clearly going to be the next big thing. All they needed was for someone to harness them, someone with the brains and the talent to pull technology and our human desire to connect into the first great social website. Someone like Divya Narendra. A handsome, brilliant New York kid of Indian descent, Narendra was in his junior year at Harvard when he had a brainwave. Imagine if you could take Harvard's many Facebooks and combine them all into a single site. It would have a social section, a dating section, and it would combine all the advantages of real-life interaction with the advantages of the Facebooks. The name for Narendra's giant online Facebook? Well, that was Harvard Connection. Clearly, Narendra was not an ad man. Still, he managed in April to rope in two identical twins, Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss. They were going to act as his money men. His team in place, Narendra, now just needed a computer guy to write the code and pull everything together. It was at this point that the ambitious young entrepreneur, he heard about FaceMash. In November of 2003, Narendra and the Winklevosses, they contacted the now notorious Mark Zuckerberg to ask if he would help them in their project. Zuckerberg, he jumped at the chance. Emails from the time that were later released are full of positivity. He told them it would take 10 hours and that he would be finished soon. Narendra and his cohorts, they rubbed their hands with glee. It would only be a matter of time before they were all filthy rich. As November ticked over into December, Zuckerberg abandoned his work on Harvard Connection. Still, though, he promised Narendra that it would be finished soon, but he began to start work on his own project. This new project was a Harvard Connection, but without all the extra crap. It would be one based on psychological insights from FaceMash. On January the 11th, 2004, Zuckerberg quietly registered the new site with his web provider. And with that, thefacebook.com appeared in the internet's records for the first time. The very next day, Zuckerberg approached his friend Eduardo Saverin to help finance the project. Saverin agreed to front $1,000. He would later say that he only caved in after Zuckerberg assured him that they'd be able to use the new site to get laid. That January the 14th, Zuckerberg finally stopped stringing Narendra along. In a face-to-face meeting, he told him that he needed to find a new programmer. Narendra pleaded with him to stay, but Zuckerberg, he was already gone. In the last frantic weeks before the Facebook launched, it dawned on Zuckerberg that he was going to fail a module on art in the time of Augustus. Therefore, he hatched a classic Zuckerberg scheme. In no time at all, he knocked up a website and encouraged his classmates to share materials on it. Within 30 minutes of the site going live, he'd amassed enough material to function as his own private crib sheet. Zuckerberg passed the module. On February the 4th, 2004, the Facebook.com finally went live. Smart, sleek, and innovative, it looked sure to be the hottest new site on campus. As you already know, though, the success of Zuckerberg and Saverin's project, it would not be confined to only Harvard. The early days of Facebook are now legendary. Over 4,000 people signed up in the first 2 weeks. By May, almost 200,000 people were on board. These figures are still impressive today, but in the innocent days of 2004, they were utterly phenomenal. Yet Zuckerberg's early success, it was accompanied by a strange defensiveness. In the student paper, The Harvard Crimson, he published an open letter describing how he always went out of his way to help people, you know, before wheeling around and attacking Narendra with all guns blazing. By the end of the article, he'd managed to turn his own intellectual property theft into a scenario where he was the victim. Not that anything about Zuckerberg's outward appearance screamed victim. Summer, he was renting an apartment in Palo Alto and trying to crack Silicon Valley. One of his last acts before leaving Harvard was to ask Saverin for an additional $20,000 for the site and for him to join Mark in California. Saverin said yes to the first and no to the second. This would not work out well for him. That June, the first Facebook headquarters appeared in a house on La Jennifer Way. It was the punk nerd mess that Zuckerberg had always dreamed of. The team spent all day drinking beer and listening to Green Day and all night programming. Zuckerberg even took to carrying around a fencing foil, sort of like a Zorro but reborn as an entitled kid from New York State. But it would take something more to catapult the new social network into the big time. Something, or maybe someone. That someone was Napster co-founder Justin Timberlake. Not really, that would be Sean Parker. He's played by Justin Timberlake in the aforementioned movie. Sean Parker just happened to be living a few blocks away from the never-ending Facebook frat party. Parker was known to Zuckerberg through Saverin, who'd introduced them at a dinner. One day, Zuckerberg just happened to be walking past his house when Parker came outside and the two recognized one another. Now, if you want to pinpoint the moment when Zuckerberg went from nerd with a dream to guy on a course to becoming the world's youngest billionaire, well, this is probably it. Parker became the Facebook's connection to Silicon Valley's big money elite. It was a connection even Zuckerberg's habit of arriving at meetings in his pajamas could not break. In August, PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel became the site's first big investor, giving them a cash injection of $500,000. Suddenly, with that, things they were looking very serious. And we mean that here in more ways than one. Around the time Thiel was coming on board, Saverin was not just being shown the door, but he was being thrown through it. In July of 2004, Saverin froze Facebook's accounts after Zuckerberg failed to match his $20,000 investment. Zuckerberg responded by transferring all of the Facebook's assets to a new version of the company that was headquartered in Delaware. This both cut Saverin out and rendered his old stock worthless. Saverin would later say that Zuckerberg screwed me. By December of 2004, the Facebook was pulling in 1 million users. Parker took over as president, and in early 2005, he forced through a name change. From this point on, the site would simply be known as Facebook. In May of that year, venture capital firm Accel Partners invested $12.7 million in Facebook. The condition, though, was that the company had to expand beyond just the Ivy League schools. That September, the site was opened to all colleges and high schools across the United States. By Christmas, there were 5.5 million users. And Zuckerberg? Well, Zuckerberg was riding high. Yahoo and MTV Networks were both fighting to buy stakes in the rising company, and the money was absolutely rolling in. The one major hiccup so far was that Parker had had to resign after being allegedly busted with cocaine at a party. But Facebook was still on a roll, and really, the only way was up. By September of 2006, Facebook was open to anyone with an email address, which set off a phenomenal growth spurt. But 2006 was also the year we got our first real look at Mark Zuckerberg. After getting burned by his programmer back in 2004, Narendra hadn't given up. Along with the Winklevoss twins, he'd launched a massive lawsuit against Zuckerberg that came to a head just as Facebook was conquering the planet. Unfortunately for Zuckerberg, this meant a lot of things from his past getting dragged up in legal depositions. Over two excruciating years, the press slowly learned how Zuckerberg had offered users private Facebook data to his friends, how he'd strung Narendra along while stealing his idea, and how he'd even once harvested passwords from Facebook to hack the email accounts of journalists at the Harvard Crimson who were sympathetic to Narendra. It was a litany of wrongdoing, the sort of scandal that could sink a lesser man. But Zuckerberg, he was lucky. Data privacy wasn't something that people really cared about yet, and he still had that aura of rebellious cool it's hard now to believe that Facebook ever had. When he eventually settled with Narendra out of court for $65 million, the world shrugged and went back to sharing cat memes. By 2008, Facebook had become a global phenomenon. Aged 23, Zuckerberg was the youngest self-made billionaire in history. Even as the rest of the planet's economy detonated in the financial crisis, Facebook, it just kept on growing. As Zuckerberg had learned himself in his miserable freshman year, no one likes to feel alone. But if you think the rest of this video is just going to be more of Zuckerberg becoming richer while casually stabbing colleagues in the back, well, prepare yourself for a bit of a twist. While the Machiavellian Zuckerberg is certainly a part of this story, there's another part too. One we haven't really touched on in the rush to get to the narrative, and that's Zuckerberg the philanthropist. It started with a $100 million donation in 2010 to save Newark's public school system from collapse. That same year, Zuckerberg signed the Giving Pledge, committing himself to giving half of his fortune away to charity. By 2015, he and his future wife, who we're going to loop back to in a moment, would be giving 99% of their fortune to charitable causes, which was a record amount. It's here we really get to the heart of what makes Zuckerberg tick. Amid all of the manipulation and scandals, it's worth remembering that at heart, he's an idealist. He really does want to make the world a better place, whether through giving or encouraging us all to connect via Facebook. But he had soon set his sights even higher. Zuckerberg didn't just want to change the world incrementally, he wanted to actively shape it, to push everyone towards a better future, whether they wanted to go there or not. Ironically, it would be this noble impulse that soon set him and his company on the road to PR disaster. In October of 2014, Mark Zuckerberg stepped out of a bright orange helicopter in the tiny Indian village of Chandiwali. It was a hot day, the air pregnant with humidity. But Zuckerberg had more in his mind than the heat. He was in Chandiwali to change the world. It had been a good 4 years to be Mark Zuckerberg. In 2012, he'd married his longtime love, Priscilla Chan, exactly one day after Facebook had gone public for the first time. Barely a year after that, he would become a father. Then there's the philanthropic work. That February, Zuckerberg unveiled something called Internet.org, which was later renamed Free Basics, a vision for planet Earth where everyone would have access to an internet connection. Connectivity is a human right, it stated. He was in India to make that vision a reality. The idea that Zuckerberg pitched to the schoolchildren of Chandiwali that October, it was simple. A free version of the internet that would give them access to 36 sites, including, of course, Facebook. As he left the village to cheers and got back in his private helicopter, Zuckerberg, he must have felt like he was doing God's work, bringing digital civilization to the internet barbarians of rural India. Only, not everyone saw it that way. In fact, to some Indian tech journalists, it sounded a lot like Free Basics violated net neutrality. Indeed, they kind of saw it as little more than digital era colonialism. Zuckerberg could, of course, have countered this narrative by listening to the concerns of these writers, but he didn't. Instead, he did what had done with Savarin and Narendra all those years ago. He struck first. This was a bad move. The scale of Facebook's attack stunned journalists. The Guardian reports that the site automatically enrolled the profiles of users into its anti-net neutrality petitions, at one point even signing up those who'd been dead for 2 years. As one Indian journalist put it, "Facebook came and shoved its ass in our faces." The campaign was so manipulative that it galvanized India against Facebook. In February of 2016, the country effectively outlawed Free Basics. Now, in the normal run of things, this would have just been one misstep in the life of a company, one more disaster that would simply be chalked up to experience. But here's the thing about the Free Basics debacle. Zuckerberg, he didn't learn. All he took away was that when the next scandal hit, he would have to fight even harder. And it wasn't long before that next scandal arrived. Not 6 months later, BuzzFeed's editor, Craig Silverman, noticed a string of false stories emerging from one small town in Macedonia, but blowing up big time across all of Facebook. Nearly all involved the presidential candidate, Donald Trump. Strangely, the stories and the sites they linked to seemed to be multiplying, and not all of them came from Macedonia. As the campaign season dragged on, others started to emerge from further east, specifically from Russia. 2 years before, an engineer at Facebook had raised the alarm about unusual levels of activity coming from Russia, but his report had just been dismissed. People were wondering whether the Russians were using Facebook to spread propaganda. Zuckerberg, he didn't think so. On November the 10th, just 2 days after Donald Trump's shock win in the bitterly contested election, he made a speech calling those worried about fake news on his website crazy. But he wasn't telling the whole truth. Facebook's own analysis, published in 2017, would reveal Russian-backed propaganda groups had reached 126 million Americans during the election. Rather than be concerned, though, Zuckerberg and his board, they issued denials. On January 6, 2017, the CIA declared that Russia had interfered in the election and that social media, particularly Facebook, had played a major role. Outwardly, Zuckerberg and his board, they simply kept on repeating their denials, but behind the scenes, panic was beginning to set in. Throughout April, Facebook launched a crackdown on fake news, hoping to pull out ahead of the scandal. But by now, it was too late. By July, Zuckerberg was claiming no evidence existed that Russian actors bought Facebook ads, only for hard evidence to emerge in September that indeed they did. That Yom Kippur, he recorded a public video asking for forgiveness. He apparently hoped this new, contrite approach would soothe over the latest scandal. Unfortunately, an even bigger scandal was already waiting in the wings. On March the 17th, 2018, a joint report by The Guardian, The New York Times, and Britain's Channel 4 revealed that a firm known as Cambridge Analytica had used third-party apps to harvest the data of 80 million Facebook users, and that data had been used to try and influence votes everywhere from the US to Great Britain to Mexico. This data didn't just come from users who'd stupidly installed these apps. Some of the apps automatically harvested the data of their friends as well. Crucially, Zuckerberg, he was aware of this. Facebook launched its Open Graph software in April of 2010, specifically to sell data, including the contents of private messages, by the way, to advertisers. In May of that year, Zuckerberg, he wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post addressing users' concerns. But nothing was done about it until 2014, and even then the changes, they weren't applied retroactively. Any company, like Cambridge Analytica, that already had its claws into your data, they didn't have to let go. The resulting scandal had exploded like a small bomb, staining the reputations of both Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg. Over 10 years after it first used data from the Facebook to hack the emails of Harvard Crimson journalists, Zuckerberg was in trouble over data privacy yet again. Only this time, he had to testify on Capitol Hill. On March the 20th, 2018, the Federal Trade Commission had launched an inquiry into Facebook. Great Britain, the EU, and others had set up similar investigations. That spring, Mark Zuckerberg privately told the Facebook board that his company was now at war. Yet still, the scandals didn't stop. At the time of this video's recording, Facebook is a company lurching from scandal to scandal, dragging its founder in its wake. Among other things, Zuckerberg's digital utopia has been accused of facilitating ethnic cleansing in Myanmar, aiding the harassment of survivors of mass shootings, and spreading negative propaganda about George Soros. Aged only 34, Mark Zuckerberg has finally lost whatever veneer of cool he and his creation once had. Rich, powerful, and utterly convinced of his own rightness, he has refused calls to step down from Facebook's board or do anything but keep on fighting. Isolated in the eye of a growing hurricane of scandal, he no longer seems like the punk nerd who upended communication, but like King Lear, raging at the sky as his world crumbles around him. Zuckerberg's story, it's not over, he's not yet 40, but his biography as it stands today is a one of warning, a strange morality tale of hubris, theft, and misplaced good intentions for our internet age. Whether the final act is one that ends in Mark Zuckerberg's redemption or his damnation is something only time will tell.
So I really hope you enjoyed that episode of the Biographics Podcast. leave us a review. Why not? You can do that wherever you get your podcasts, or a rating, or however these things work. I like reading them. It makes me feel good when they're positive. It lets me know what you don't like when they're negative. Also, if you want to say hi, say let me know how I'm doing with this podcast, just drop me an email. It's simon@biographics.org. Biographics spelled the same way that the name of this podcast is spelled. So again, that's simon@biographics.org. Drop me an email, say hi, let me know how you like this podcast. And as always, I'll see you next time.